Around the world, ride-sharing schemes have transformed the way cities move and have given people a fun and healthy option for getting around town. Borrowing a bike as a mobility solution has taken off in cities big and small, but of course, it's never easy. Schemes collapse, funding dries up, cities are still potholed and congested, bikes of all shapes and sizes are strewn across the pavement, and slow-pedaling tourists riding in all the wrong places still annoy us all. But nonetheless, new bike-sharing companies are still cropping up. And on the streets of London, there is a new player in town, the sharp-looking mint-green bikes of Barrel. The company was launched by Emily Brook, originally called Blaze and Making Lights. Out of a university project to create a product to make cycling safer, Emily crowdfunded money to make laser lights. A green glowing image of a bike is projected onto the road in front of riders, making them more visible. While also selling consumer lights to dozens of countries around the world, the company really took off when the technology was integrated into Santander Cycles in London, and later added to the bike sharing schemes in cities including New York, Montreal, and Glasgow. In the first few years, Emily managed to raise more than £1 million, and the success of the laser lights earned her an MBE for services to transport and the economy. Today, Emily and Barrel are on a mission to make bike sharing better. And along with spending plenty of time improving their bikes and adding new technology, the company is determined to consult with cities every step of the way to get more people riding. You're listening to The Entrepreneurs with me, Daniel Bage. For this week's episode, I sat down with Emily at Midori House to hear the story of Barrel, a company named for another heroine of British cycling.
Yeah, Blaze began at university. I was a girl that could do science and maths, so went to Oxford University and read physics, which was apparently important for my career in the city that I apparently also wanted, but then dropped out to go and do design, which is what I actually wanted to be doing all along, and went into product design in Brighton. The laser light, which was our first product, was my final year project at Brighton.
That took a little while to get off the ground, if I understand. You had a very successful crowdfunding campaign, but obviously in the design and getting that to market took a little bit of time. Can you walk us through that a little bit?
Yeah, it took a long time. We launched Kickstarter back in 2012, and it was the month that Kickstarter came to the UK, which is kind of crazy because nobody really quite knew what it was about. I didn't quite understand this whole concept of giving money before you get a product. And I started the business about 2 months before that, really. So it was really early to be doing a Kickstarter. And then with the kind of first time hardware entrepreneur optimism, I think my advice to anybody starting out with launching a physical product would be whatever timeline you think, triple it, and whatever budget, quadruple it. So yeah, it was about an 18-month learning curve of manufacturing in China for the first time. But we did halfway through that ask our backers because we had an option to deliver something better, but it's going to take more time. So they were involved in that process, but yeah, it took longer than we thought.
You're obviously learning a lot about manufacturing, but also about running a business at that time as well. How was that initial journey for you? Was it anything like you expected, or was it sort of all trial and error?
I had no idea what I was getting myself into. I'd never had a job before, let alone started a business. I'd never really sat in a corporate office before, let alone. And I guess maybe that's why we've had the kind of a bit of a agile energy ever since then. But yeah, I think the most important thing in that time of learning was, for example, going out to China. I think I did 5 trips in my first year. Going out there and the kind of conversations you have across the desk with the people who are actually manufacturing the goods and solving the problems cuts out weeks of back and forth. And I kind of miss those early days where you did a bit of everything, whether it's manufacturing or design or the legal entities of incorporating a business to the marketing to every single aspect of it. I mean, it was myself and an intern for quite a while in the beginning. And now a team of 50, and I feel like I don't really do much.
I'm sure you do something, but I remember this as being on the city bikes. Eventually, you got involved with the city, and that's really, I imagine, where this took off. Or was it on the sort of more commercial light that you're selling?
No, absolutely, spot on. It was the integration of the city bikes and the one here in London, really. That was TfL, Transport for London, who adopted the technology after 12 weeks of really extensive, quite nerve-wracking testing, which basically proved it was effective, which was great. But we equipped all 12,500 bikes here in London with lasers. And then we got the commission a couple of years later to do basically co-design the new bike for London. And for that, we did lights, laser, GPS, Bluetooth, sensors, connectivity, all the tech on board the bike. And by working with one of the world's most complicated and, I'd argue, best run bike share schemes in the world, we learned a lot about running bike share.
You got to get involved with TfL and really learn from working underneath them. Was that a good experience for you, do you think, moving forward?
Yeah, I mean, it was crazy. It was TfL and Serco. So Serco had the contract to operate the London bikes. And they're a 70,000 person company. And we at the time were probably, I mean, went from probably 7 to 12. I think we're the guys that kind of were innovating and moved fast and caused a bit of chaos. And it was a lot of learning on both sides, how to kind of communicate more than anything and deliver a project together. But it was also our biggest breakthrough moment. I mean, getting our technology on those bikes. I can remember, you know, having a tough day in the office, and when they started to be adopted, you kind of come out of the office late at night in the winter evening and suddenly see a green laser zooming past, you know, every 4 minutes or something. It's quite bonkers.
I guess at that point, it was more easy to describe to people you were meeting about what you were doing. They would know exactly what you're talking about.
Totally.
I mean, for people that haven't seen it or haven't ridden one of the bikes in London, this is that green laser that is out in front of the bike. How did the trajectory for the actual consumer product go? Because you were selling individual torches as well. I remember seeing a challenge on Strava or something where you could win one. How did that go? I know there was a bit of an issue with the naming of the company, and that was a bit of a hiccup.
Yeah, so we were Blaze originally, and now we're Beryl. Blaze, we had a trademark dispute in the US, so we had to rename. So we renamed to Beryl. But the lights, the consumer lights, which is where we started, we then launched some other lights. We launched the Burner, which is the backlight, and had a light sensor. And then now we've got the new generations. We've got the new laser light core and the new burner brake, which has a brake light feature in it, and the Pixel, which is a tiny little light that can be either a front light or a backlight, red or white. Clip it to your clothing or your helmet or your dog or your partner that runs or whatever. Our heritage was in the consumer electronics business, and then we've now done this massive pivot into bike share. And we had about 15 people at the top working on the consumer electronics business, you know, marketing and distribution and everything. And now we've basically got one person. He does our sales. And having almost taken our eye off the ball of that side of the company, it's suddenly going really well. We're selling loads of lights. The new ones we launched late last season. The bike light season is very seasonal. People buy bike lights. And the clocks change the end of October to Christmas. 2 months, we had a functioning business. And then you have to start all over again before the next year. And the new lights came halfway through the season last year. And then this season is their first full season. So really exciting to get those new products out there. And so far, people like them. That's good.
Well, we're coming into that season where it's darker outside and people are starting to think about that as London gets more grey and more dark. With the lights, you did a lot of research and you already mentioned working with TfL, proving that this does work and making people visible. But when you transitioned, as you already mentioned, what was that about? What problem were you trying to solve there? You already worked with the biggest bike sharing company, so to move into bike sharing, that seems like an interesting career or company shift.
Yeah, we're a little business, we've got big ambitions. And our mission from day one has been very clear and been the same. So our mission, I guess you should say purpose. Our purpose is to build a better world by getting more people in cities on bikes. And that stayed the same. And that's what we try to do. And it started off with tackling the biggest barrier to cycling, which is safety. So the laser light tackled that barrier by tackling the most common cause of accident. And we delivered more products that hopefully encourage people to feel safer and get on the bike. And now we're doing the whole thing. We're doing the bike. We're doing bike share. And that came about because by putting our technology into the London bikes, as I said before, we kind of learned a lot about bike share. There was the two ends of the spectrum at the time. There was either the fixed infrastructure docked systems that you have in the main capitals around the world, which are incredibly expensive and have real trouble scaling. You've got to dig up the road, put in infrastructure. They're very limited by the docks, which dock is full, which dock is empty, driving vans around, rebalancing bikes. Or you had this scale fast, leave anywhere, dockless model that was coming out of Asia. In fact, before that even came, we were thinking about this, but there was a kind of opportunity to do it using technology a little bit smarter. And we were thinking about doing it as a joint venture with a much bigger company at the time. And then as we were kind of progressing, we realized that we kind of had the building blocks ourselves, the understanding, and we'd been in this industry for many years and the other players actually hadn't. So we set about building it ourselves. And that's what we've been doing for the last couple of years and launched this summer.
People in cities around the world, lots of global cities, they'll be used to this bike sharing scheme. And they look and feel very different. There's many different iterations of that. I think in London, I know of about four, and perhaps there are more. But really, what problem do you feel you can solve here? Because it seems an interesting place to move into where the market and the competition is very strong.
I think the biggest thing that we've been focusing on is a sustainable model. So a bike share system that's there to last. And there's a few things. I mean, the devil's in the detail, but the thing is, it's a really good bike. It's a really high quality bike. We designed it with our internal design team and a guy who's designed the city bikes in New York and some really fantastic bikes. So it's designed to last on street. It's not designed just to be a bit of plastic that ends up in landfill after a month or two. And the big difference is the technology on board that bike. Our bikes are fully connected, always live, always online. We always know where they are, which means we can do accurate geofenced parking, So we have what we're calling our barrel bays, and people are incentivized to go and park the bike back in a bay. And a bay is just some paint on the road. It's no physical infrastructure, and you can see them in the app when you rent the bike. But you also, it's a hybrid model, you also have the flexibility of parking it wherever you want, but you pay a small premium to do that. Cities like it because the bikes are left neat and tidy and in a bay. Users like it because they know where they can find the bikes. They know that in the street there's going to be a bay of 10 bikes. And we as an operator like it because it helps with the operations of balancing the bikes and servicing and maintenance. But it's the technology not just on the bike, but also the platform behind it that enables us to operate and manage a fleet of vehicles quite efficiently.
You already mentioned that cities are quite keen to get involved. They're looking for solutions as well going forward to get more people on bikes as cities are congested and transit is an issue. But how keen really are cities involved in this conversation with you in trying to develop both the technology and the bikes and the whole platform in general?
Very good question, but it's like incredibly surprisingly interested. They've been through a whole kind of mental progression on this where not so long ago, I mean, a couple of years ago, less than that, they had to pay for bike share schemes and a lot of money. The fixed infrastructure was incredibly, incredibly expensive. Then came along this kind of wave of dockless where they kind of thought, oh, they can get it for free. That didn't deliver the results that cities and users wanted, and it caused chaos in many places. And now they're coming back around to actually realising that they want a proper scheme. They kind of have to pay for it in part, or are offering to pay for it in part, and it needs to be managed properly. So they're asking for KPIs, they're asking and wanting to be involved, which is great, especially for us because we want to, for example, put down our barrel bays, and we need to work really closely with the city and the local authorities on that. And the schemes that we've launched so far, it's been very much a kind of working incredibly closely with the city to build a scheme that serves their population. And they know their city better than we do. And it's been, yeah, very much a kind of combined effort rather than just kind of dump vehicles and see what happens. Cities are genuinely dedicated to improving the way people move about, and they've got, you know, policy behind that and now funding as well. There's government's capital bazooka of transforming cities funding, where there's the 12 at the moment cities. They've got this capital to change many things, but mobility and bikes is a big part of that. We're now going after the kind of the bid, the old-fashioned way. They've gone back to kind of releasing contracts and awarding contracts for cities, which was what we're going for.
You hear a lot about companies that are working in the mobility space, and mostly these days it's the electric scooters that are popping up everywhere in the world. And those are all grown in the tech model where, you know, get a lot of funding, grow it really fast, and then it doesn't really matter what happens to it in the end. But I sense that you're obviously thinking more long-term about this, where it's not simply build a bunch of bikes, throw them out there, move on to the next venture. It seems not the way.
Yeah, the scooter models. I could talk about scooters till the cows come home, but it's a constant topic of conversation with my co-founder and I. There's a few challenges for them. The safety is a real concern, and we're beginning to see the data come out from hospitals, which when otherwise it was just reported as road traffic, is now actual kind of scooter accidents, and the numbers are scary. The fact that these vehicles, as you say, they're not lasting long on the street. Some providers of days rather than weeks, and they become landfill, which to me is just heart-wrenching more than baffling. And this kind of equity funding cycle to replace those vehicles to me also doesn't make much sense. I can understand why it happened. I think the barrier to entry was relatively low. Those vehicles aren't wildly expensive, so you can deploy many of them overnight, and they're good fun. People jump on them in the first few weeks and months, and you get great metrics out the door. But as a sustainable transport option, I don't believe in it in its current form. And the other thing is, the data kind of shows those journeys aren't really, not replacing modal shift, they're not replacing, you know, a journey that you would otherwise be in a car or on a bus or some other form of transport. It's typically journeys you would walk. It's not active transport, and it's sort of a distance that somebody should otherwise probably, you know, a quarter of a mile or something be walking, which also doesn't really solve problems that cities today are facing.
I'm curious about just the impact on how people get around, and if you've been able to sort of gather any data or glean any insight from the early days of this venture.
It's very different. I mean, Europe is very different from America. America's obviously kind of car design, car focused. So you'll often see that the journeys that bikes, e-bikes and scooters are replacing are walking and cars. Whereas in Europe, we've got, by necessity probably more than anything, got quite complex transport networks. And so you are often getting people sometimes off public transport as much, if not more, than you are cars. But the good old-fashioned bike, in the world, we will be electric tomorrow. We'll be electric very, very soon. And there's a need for that, especially for the longer journeys coming out from trunking areas, coming out from out of town into town. But just from getting across town, the good old-fashioned bike is arguably your best, most efficient, quickest, most environmentally friendly, most enjoyable way to get across most cities, I'd say.
You mentioned the e-bike that you are testing and will be coming soon. What is on your plate these days leading this venture and going forward? What do you spend most of your time working on? You said nothing, but I don't believe that. I imagine that you must have a lot going on.
I really isn't much. It is extraordinary. I can do go in the office and think, what do I do today? But we are an ambitious company. And if we want to go and play on the global scale of some of these massive micro-mobility players, we will probably need a capital injection at some point to do that. So beginning to think of looking at kind of next year and what our growth strategy might be. Partnership and capital-wise, which is quite exciting because we've got a pipeline of some really big schemes to go after. But there's a lot in the UK right now, and no small reason because scooters are currently illegal here and the bike is proving a pretty good way to solve lots of these problems. But if we want to go international and we want to do it properly, then I'm beginning to think of ways of doing that.
Will that be the only way to get it done, really, or to be the next success story in the bike sharing world? Because I imagine it's in partnership with a city or a transit authority rather than just showing up in a city and spreading your bikes around.
Absolutely. Now, we are not deploying anywhere without winning a contract. And that's what we're doing at the moment. And there's these contracts coming up at the moment have got some sizable funding behind them, which massively decreases the capex risks of deploying bikes, which is fantastic. But the ones on the horizon at the moment are contracts that we're going for.
I think I used to live in Paris and I always think of what happened there and sort of they had this perfect scheme and then they blew it, really. And then It was a real mess for a while. But there are other places which might be desperate to have a good scheme or to have a partner they could work with. Are there any places specifically that you're looking at or that you would be excited to move into?
So many. I mean, even the small towns, there's a great long tail of small towns that don't have the public transport networks that the bigger ones enjoy that would really, you know, benefit from a bike share scheme. Bournemouth has been a really interesting place for us to launch. It's down by the coast in the UK. It's a beautiful city, but they have really bad traffic. They have kind of one major road artery that goes around the whole system. And especially in the summer with the tourists, they get apparently 10 million tourists a year, all of which seem to be stuck in traffic. But they've got good bike lanes, a good bike infrastructure. So the bike share scheme there has been really well appreciated and it's been a joy to kind of work with them on that and see it genuinely, it sounds a big statement, but genuinely change lives. We went down, took the whole company down for an offsite last month or month before, and we advertised that we were going to be down there and did a kind of open show of the bikes. People can come and try them. And people came just to say thank you. And it was kind of these wonderful stories. There's a lady who came with her family, basically show her family WhatsApp chat, which every picture of the last 3 weeks was kind of different family members on a Breville bike. And, you know, this is their sister-in-law on the way back from the pub. This is their son and daughter. This is, you know, and there's a lady who lived in Edinburgh, but come down quite regularly because her mum was very sadly in hospital. She said it was very tough. She'd been in hospital all day with her mum, but then at lunchtime she'd get out and get on a Breville bike and go and get some fresh air down by the seaside, and it changed the whole day for her. And it's just like some really wonderful stories of people, a lady my age who'd broken her back very seriously in two places cycling and had been too scared to get on a bike for many years. And then our Breville bikes were popping up in town. So eventually got on one for the first time and now rides a bike every day and she loves it. So that was kind of really gratifying, hearing the stories of people who use the bikes, and that's what it's kind of about. It's not for cyclists necessarily. The bikes are for just everyday people who just want to cross where they live.
And tell us about Beryl, because it's actually named for someone.
Yeah. Beryl, there's a great big long story as to how you've ended up with Beryl. But from day one, I wanted one syllable that begins with a B to have some continuity from Blaze, which is really tricky. I mean, everything, every word that you can possibly think of that could be connected to cycling in some way was taken. And the lawyers would come back with something. We'd eventually get something which looked clean and the lawyers would come back and have 76 potential infringement cases next to it. And eventually kind of, there was a friend in America actually who gave me the idea and she mentioned this name Beryl Burton. And I said, no, I've never heard of Beryl Burton. Who's Beryl Burton? And Beryl Burton was a complete rock star. She dominated British cycling in the 60s and 70s. She won something like 70 domestic championship medals and 7 world championship medals. She set the men's time trial 12-hour record, which no other man beat for another 2 years, and another woman for another 50 years. And she never went pro. She worked 12 hours in a rhubarb farm to pay for her cycling and just was a complete badass. So Beryl, and then the other thing about Beryl, which is lovely, is the word Beryl actually comes from a green emerald, so a green gemstone. That green light you see on the streets of London and New York and other cities now, that green light has a link back to an emerald.
And the beautiful paint scheme of the new bikes as well.
Thank you.
Emily Brooke, founder of Beryl. You're listening to The Entrepreneurs with me, Daniel Bache. Now, it's time for the third and final installment of our How Do I series to coincide with Monocle's brand new annual print title, The Entrepreneurs. For this week's segment, we caught up with Marie Perrochet for some advice on perfecting the pitch. Perrochet is an international marketing and communications director who has worked with Netflix, LinkedIn, and Adidas alongside hundreds of international entrepreneurs from more than 50 countries. She's also the author of One Perfect Pitch: How to Sell Your Idea, Your Product, Your Business, or Yourself. She spoke to Fernand Van Tetz.
The main takeaways, the first one is really getting a framework. You need to create a framework before pitching to anyone. It's important to have a structure to ensure that your ideas and the message will come across very clearly. The second takeaway would be to practice, because practice makes perfect. The third takeaway would be to think about your audience, you know, what's in for them. A great pitch is a short message that lasts 1 minute or 5 minutes that compels someone to take action after that. An even greater pitch is if you're telling a story, because the story is really what helps you connect and engage with your audience. We've all read stories when we were young as children. We know the narrative, we know scenarios, we watch movies that are relying upon really strong narratives with characters, with loss, struggle, transformation. But actually, a lot of entrepreneurs and people working at companies, they don't know how to use the narrative to convey clearly their message. The storytelling strategy that I put in that framework actually is very simple. And I'd like to create and share an image that I found when I was driving in Silicon Valley, which is what happens after a storm. There's a rainbow, and at the end of the rainbow, supposedly, there's a pot of gold. And so the structure for a pitch, a story that you'd like to tell, is very similar to this. You know, you talk about the struggle at the beginning, the problems or the pain points that you've identified as an entrepreneur. Then after, you talk about the solution, which is the rainbow. And then at the end, you talk about the transformation that your business is bringing, which is the pot of gold. So it's a very simple structure that in any time you're willing to pitch your idea will help you be very effective when pitching. When it comes to a perfect pitch, the first rule is to be as clear as possible and as precise as possible. Don't lose yourself using sentences that don't mean anything or words that are not expressing a clear idea, because people can't, when they listen to you, paint an image, understand what you're doing. The second rule would be to not lose any moment and pitch your idea in the first 10 seconds, because you're competing for attention. If you don't capture your audience's attention right away, people, they will lose interest. The third rule, I would say, that works well is really to be authentic, because if your pitch sounds too rehearsed, too phony, people will get disconnected and think that you're fake. And when you're competing against other entrepreneurs who probably have the same idea but are coming from different countries with different skills, you really want to tell an authentic story about yourself.
So how do you strike that balance between preparation and authenticity?
So we strike the balance between preparation and authenticity just by practicing and being very flexible and adapt yourself to the situation. By practicing, I mean, and I give a very similar image, when you start learning how to drive for the first time, you're all tense and everybody's so stressed next to you. But after a few years, you drive and you actually are doing other things that you're not supposed to do, like, you know, talking to the passenger, looking at your phone, talking to the back seats. When you're pitching, it's the same. You know, you should be able to tell your pitch in a very noisy environment with many distractions, but with confidence. And striking the balance also requires being very adaptable. If you have a too rehearsed pitch, it will sound very robotic, very phony, like maybe some of our politicians who rehearse their message regardless of their audience. And this is not the effect that you want to convey. You really want to convey the effect that you're speaking to a real person and you really care about them and you really want to solve a pain point for them. Try to adapt and understand who they are, maybe posing, asking them questions. and then trying to see what resonates best for them. The practice and really adapting to your audience is really key as well in perfecting your pitch. For example, when I got to Silicon Valley, I'm from Europe, I've been traveling before, but I didn't know anything about an elevator pitch. So I would go to events, startup events, I would introduce myself. It would be very clear to people what I was trying to convey, which was helping companies deliver their story. And so what I would do, because also I'm a non-native English speaker, I would actually listen to people and hear them reformulate what I'm doing. And then I would take notes and make it better. And then I would go to as many events as possible, pitch, until I would feel very comfortable and be able to clearly convey my message in any types of situations. In terms of practice makes perfect, striking the balance, two things. You can practice in front of your mirror. I've worked with this entrepreneur where this entrepreneur had to speak on stage. I told him, hey, you know, you really want to first, you know, check the room, but also so that you can visualize yourself in this specific environment. But you also want to practice in front of your mirror to see if you're breathing, if you're taking space, if you're really feeling yourself like you're on stage for the following morning. So that would be the first step. And the second step would be to record yourself with your cell phone, with your computer. In your Mac, for example, you have the photo booth option. Use your phone or your iPad. And then you can really see what is the message and how strong you are when you're telling your story. An interesting thing is to actually replay the image without the sound so that you can spot any mistakes that you're making that are deserving the strength and the power of your message.
Marie Perrichet speaking to Fernand Van Tetz in Amsterdam. My thanks to both and to Monocle's Marie-Sophie Schwartzer for producing this segment over the past 3 weeks. And remember, The Entrepreneur's Our Business Handbook and new annual print title is on fine newsstands now. That's all for today's show. My thanks to our studio manager, Maylee Evans, for mixing and editing this program. I'm Daniel Bache. Thank you so much for listening and goodbye.